What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody. I think we are just going to get right into today's episode. I need to pull up my notes and block myself because I just tried to clean my computer camera and now it's all I can see are streaks and it's driving me nuts. So if anyone was wondering how recording today was going, that's what's happening. All right, so today's case is a solved murder case, and it was a suggestion sent in by one of our listeners. There was no name attached, so I don't know who sent it in, but thank you to whoever did, because I had never heard this case before. And just a quick trigger warning before we get into it, we will be talking about sexual assault in this case, so I just wanted to put a blanket trigger warning at the start of the episode here. On January 6th, 2007, 21-year-old Shannon Christian and 23-year-old Christopher Newsom were carjacked, kidnapped, tortured, and murdered in Knoxville, Tennessee. Shannon was a senior at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville studying sociology, and she was planning to graduate in December of that year. Chris had become a carpenter after attending the Pellissippi State Technical Community College. And I couldn't find how long Shannon and Chris had been dating in 2007, but they were a couple. They were together. January 6th was a Saturday, and that evening, Shannon had gone to her best friend's apartment in Washington Ridge to get ready for another friend's birthday party. So Shannon and Chris were planning to get dinner and then go to the party together. So around 8 p.m., Shannon's friends were ready, so they left for the party and Shannon stayed behind to meet up with Chris. But when Shannon and Chris never showed up for the party that night, their friends began to worry. They were texting and calling them but got no responses. And at around 11 p.m. that night, two of Chris's friends actually left the party and went back to the apartment complex to check on them. And there they found Chris's car in the parking lot, but missing was Shannon's SUV, along with Shannon and Chris.
Okay.
And can I just say, these are some awesome friends, because I feel like, I mean, we don't know the exact dynamics of their friendship and their relationship and stuff, but I feel like in this type of scenario, friends would usually just be like, oh, they probably just decided to go do their own thing, like, that's whatever, we'll see them tomorrow. And wouldn't go check on them that night. But in this case, the friends literally were like, no, this is weird. We're going to check on them. And they found Shannon's car missing. So they, you know, they probably, I think they still kind of thought it was weird, but they were also like, okay, well, clearly they left and took Shannon's car. So, right. You know, it's not like both of their cars were there, but they weren't there or something like that. The next morning, Dina Christian, Shannon's mother, awoke with a bad feeling. She said that she got a call from Shannon's best friend saying that Shannon and Chris had never showed up for the party the night before. And then shortly after that, Shannon's boss called Dina to tell her that Shannon hadn't come into work that morning. And that was when Dina knew that something had to be wrong, so she called the police. Unfortunately, though, because Shannon and Chris were adults, the police couldn't intervene until 24 hours after they were last seen because they're adults. They can go do whatever they want, which, I mean, that is fair and it makes sense why they can't intervene right away. And at least it's just a 24-hour thing, not,
yeah.
I feel like typically you hear like 48 hours or something like that. But the police couldn't do anything right away. So while they waited for the 24-hour mark, Shannon's family actually called Chris's family, and Chris was a couple years older than Shannon, and I don't think he lived at home, or if he did, it wasn't super abnormal for his parents to not see him all the time. And so they didn't know that Chris was missing. It had been 12-ish hours, maybe a little bit more, and they weren't worried that they hadn't heard from him. But when Shannon's mom called them and said, hey, Chris never showed up for this party and now nobody knows where he is, they obviously became worried. So Shannon and Chris's families began searching on their own because nobody else could do anything. Shannon's family was also able to contact their phone provider to figure out where her phone had last been, and they found that her phone had last pinged at a Cherry Street phone tower. So they began searching in that area, and by 1:30 a.m. that night, which is now technically the morning of Monday, January 8th, Shannon's dad found her Toyota 4Runner abandoned.
Uh-oh.
With that, obviously, their fears intensified. Unbeknownst to the Christians and the Newsoms at the time, at 12:20 p.m. on January 7th, so this is the Sunday, a male's burned body was found at a nearby railroad track.
Oh my God.
The body was found by a Norfolk County Railroad employee, and it was still smoking in the aftermath of the fire. And this body, unfortunately, was Chris Newsom.
Oh my gosh.
So a comforter was wrapped around his body and a sweatshirt was wrapped around his head. His feet were bare and muddy, indicating that he had been forced to walk barefoot in this area where he was found before he was killed. Authorities determined that he had been bound, raped, shot 3 times, and then set on fire.
That is horrifying. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. There was actually semen found inside of his body, but the police weren't able to get any usable DNA because it was destroyed from that fire. One homicide detective on the scene actually knew Chris Newsom because his son was friends with him. And so he was able to identify that it was Chris, and he later told Chris's parents that he knew it was Chris because of his eyes. Chris had piercing, like, greenish brown hazel eyes. So once authorities determined that this was Chris Newsom, they knew that they had to find Shannon as quickly as possible. They were able to examine her abandoned vehicle, and they found that the front seats had been pushed so far back that Shannon could not have driven the car in that state. They found several of Shannon's belongings inside the car, including a teddy bear, photos, a phone charger, and an iPod. All of these things Shannon typically kept in her car, so they were all still there. But the stickers that Shannon had on her windows had been removed. And then also inside of the car, they found the floorboards covered in mud. They found a pack of Newport cigarettes and an envelope, and these were all, like, inconsistent with things that Shannon would have in her car. But thankfully, that envelope had a fingerprint on it, and that fingerprint matched a man named LaMarcus Davidson. So police quickly headed to his house, which was just 2 blocks away from where Shannon's car was found. When police arrived at 2316 Chipman Street on Tuesday, January 9th, they found the house unoccupied. They started looking around, and in the trash can in the kitchen, they discovered Shannon's body stuffed into 5 large trash bags.
Her mm-hmm. body was in the, like, the kitchen trash can?
That's what, she was in a trash can. From what I understood, it was the kitchen trash can, but I feel like it could have been the outside trash can.
Okay.
But either way, she was in...
She was stuffed, like, into it.
She was wrapped in multiple trash bags and stuffed into a trash can.
That's terrible.
Yeah. They found that some sort of chemical had been poured over her body to try to destroy DNA evidence, but it didn't work. Because at that house and on her body, they found so much evidence.
Good.
So first of all, Davidson's fingerprints were on the trash bags. They were on a box of more trash bags. His semen was found on and inside of Shannon. Inside the house, they also found Shannon's purse, clothing that she had in her car, her shoes, her camera, more photos, and her iPod. They also, inside the house, found Chris's baseball cap and driver's license.
Did they find any other DNA? Because I'm assuming there was more than one person to blame here.
Yeah, and I'll get to that in a
minute. Okay.
Several of the belongings that they found had Davidson's fingerprints on them. So, you know, they could link him directly to this. In addition to that, they found shell casings at the house that matched the bullets that were used to kill Chris. So they knew that they had their guy, but Davidson wasn't at the house, so a manhunt for him immediately began. The police learned that Davidson had recently been in contact with a man named Eric Boyd, and the police were able to locate Boyd, and he directed them to a different vacant house that he believed that Davidson had been staying in. So on January 11th, 5 days after the murders, LaMarcus Davidson was arrested at that house. At that house, police also found Chris Newsom's athletic shoes and a .22 caliber gun. So when police began interrogating Davidson, he told several different stories, but they all included several other people. So this was George Thomas, Latelvis Cobbins, Vanessa Coleman, and Eric Boyd. So just a little bit of background on a couple of them. LaMarcus Davidson was originally from Memphis, Tennessee, and he had just, in August 2006, so like 5 months before this, he had completed a 5-year sentence in Tennessee on a felony conviction of carjacking and aggravated robbery.
Jeez.
So 5 months before this, he had been let out of jail. At the time of the murders, his girlfriend had reportedly just broken up with him, and he needed money, a car. He pretty much had nothing going for him. That is the closest thing that we have to motive in this case, because other than that, just needing money, a car, maybe wanting to kill somebody, there's not much motive.
Okay.
And as a side note, Davidson was actually later indicted for another robbery at a Pizza Hut the day after the murders. So like before he was caught. So he was not a good guy.
No.
Latelvis Cobbins was actually Davidson's half-brother. In 2003, he had been convicted in New York on a third-degree attempted robbery charge, but obviously he had gotten out and was back in Tennessee. So the first story that Davidson told was that he had actually left that house on Friday before the murders and that he knew nothing about what happened. He then changed his story to saying that his brother, Cobbins, and one of the other guys, Thomas, arrived at his house around 10 p.m. on Friday, telling him, Davidson, that they had carjacked some people and those people were in the car outside. He claimed that he saw the victims tied up in the back seat and he didn't want any part of it, so he left the house to smoke weed. Yeah. He said that he returned 20 minutes later to find Shannon still alive, begging to not die. And he claimed that he left again, taking Shannon's car to deal drugs. And he said that afterwards he tried to wipe it clean to, you know, get rid of his DNA. But obviously that didn't work because one of his fingerprints was inside.
Yep.
He claimed that he never went further into the house than the living room and that he never raped Shannon. But as I mentioned, his DNA was found inside of Shannon's body. So yes, he did.
Yeah, his semen was found. Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay.
So this story kind of kept changing, but after finding Davidson and getting this story, the police needed to locate the three others. So eventually, they located and arrested Thomas, Cobbins, and Vanessa Coleman. In the arrest, police seized a computer that Thomas and Cobbins had been viewing news coverage of the murders on. They also seized a purse that contained Shannon's cosmetic bag and one of her change purses and Shannon's overnight bag. So, like, now they're connected.
Yeah.
Cobbins' story was that he, his brother Davidson, and Eric Boyd drove to an apartment complex for one of them to meet up with a girl. But when they arrived, they saw an SUV with a female in the driver's seat speaking to a male. Cobbins claimed that Davidson and Boyd, quote, basically carjacked them and then ordered him to drive their car back to Chipman Street. He said that once they got back to Davidson's house, he took the woman into a bedroom and Boyd drove away with the man. He claimed that Boyd returned later without the man, and he also denied raping Shannon. But his DNA was also found inside of Shannon. So once again, we know that that's not true. Vanessa Coleman admitted to being in the house that night, but she claimed that she had been held hostage by the four men as well, and that she took no part in the murders. However, a journal entry was recovered when she was arrested, and this was verified to be her handwriting. The entry said, quote, "Last night was one of a kind. We stayed with a crackhead that is cool as hell. It snowed a little bit, but it's already melted. Let's talk about adventures. I had one hell of an adventure since I've been in the big TN. It's a crazy world these days, but I love the fun adventures and lessons that I've learned. It's going to be a long, interesting year.
Okay, how old is this girl?
I don't actually know, but like, I think in her 20s, like,
I was gonna say, it sounds very like high school journal entry. And also, if she was being held, why didn't she report it?
Mm-hmm. Or write that in her journal.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, no. She was not being held.
Mm-mm. No.
So, prosecutors believed that Shannon had been held prisoner inside of Davidson's home by Coleman, Vanessa, while the three men left to go murder Chris. When they returned, they beat and raped Shannon. She had several injuries, including very bad head injuries, carpet burn, and she had several injuries from the sexual assault that she endured. So I'm not going to go into more details, especially the sexual assault, because it is very graphic, but just know that what she endured was absolutely horrific.
Sounds like it.
And then her cause of death was suffocation by the plastic bag she was placed in. Nope. The injuries, the head injuries, none of that killed her, and she was not dead. She was put into those trash bags, and she died by suffocation. She died with her eyes open.
Oh, that's like a terrible way to go. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just one bag, so you can't, like, claw your way out. Literally five bags. She probably was extremely weak.
Yeah.
And she just couldn't do anything. That is, oh, it's just so terrifying. So after all of this, Davidson, Thomas, Cobbins, and Coleman were indicted in Knox County, Tennessee. Thomas, Cobbins, and Davidson, so the three men, were indicted on 46 total charges. So this was 16 counts of felony murder, 2 counts of premeditated murder, 2 counts of especially aggravated robbery, 4 counts of especially aggravated kidnapping, 20 counts of aggravated rape, and 2 counts of theft.
Wow.
Cobbins was also charged with assaulting a correctional officer while he was in jail awaiting trial. Vanessa Coleman was indicted on 12 counts of felony murder, 1 count of premeditated murder, 1 count of especially aggravated robbery, 4 counts of especially aggravated kidnapping, 20 counts of aggravated rape, and 2 counts of theft.
Jeez.
So their trials were all scheduled to happen separately between May and August 2008. This later got pushed back to 2009. Thomas's attorneys filed for a motion for a speedy trial because there was no forensic link between him and the crime scene.
Hmm.
His motion was granted and his trial began on August 11th, 2008. And then on December 9th or 8th, 2009, George Thomas was found guilty on multiple counts, including 4 capital counts. So he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Good.
On August 23rd, 2007, so backing up a little bit to just a couple of months after the murders, Eric Boyd was indicted by a separate grand jury in the Eastern District of Tennessee. And I couldn't figure out exactly why he was indicted by a separate jury, but he was, for some reason, separated from the Knoxville grand jury.
Okay.
So this grand jury returned a superseding indictment charging him with being an accessory to a carjacking resulting in serious bodily injury to another person and a misprison of a felony. On April 16th, 2008, Eric Boyd was found guilty in federal court of being accessory to a fatal carjacking and of failing to report the location of a known fugitive. He was the only suspect that was not charged with murder because I don't think they had any proof that he had actually committed a murder.
Yeah.
And he was sentenced to 18 years in federal prison.
Wow.
On August 25th, 2009, Latelvis Cobbins was found guilty of the murders of Shannon and Chris. He was found guilty of facilitating Chris's murder, but he was acquitted of Chris's rape. He faced the death penalty. But on August 26, 2009, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Good.
On October 28, 2009, LaMarcus Davidson was found guilty on 4 capital charges, two first-degree felony murder charges and premeditated first-degree murder charges for both Shannon and Chris. And he was sentenced to death for his charges. In June 2010, he was sentenced to another 80 years for other charges related to the murders. And during his sentencing, Judge Baumgartner said, quote, "The crime was one of the most incredibly outrageous, cruel, and inhumane acts this court has ever seen. How people can engage in this type of conduct is just unexplainable. And there really is no sentence great enough to punish you for the conduct that you have been convicted of." In 2016, Davidson's conviction and death sentence was reaffirmed by the Tennessee Supreme Court. Vanessa Coleman was the last defendant to face trial, and she was actually granted immunity by federal employees, or authorities, not employees, for her testimony against the others. So this is at a federal level, and she was granted immunity. But the state court ruled that her federal immunity could not be extended to the state charges of murder and rape.
Good.
On May 13th, 2010, Vanessa Coleman was acquitted of first-degree murder, but she was found guilty of several of the lesser charges. On July 30th, 2010, she was sentenced to 53 years in prison. And at her sentencing, Shannon's father read a victim impact statement that said, quote, "For me personally, you took my baby. You took my opportunity to say yes to a young man one day. You took my wedding dance away. You took my opportunity to hold her child, my grandbaby."
That is so sad. That literally gave me goosebumps. That's so sad.
I know. It's so heartbreaking. But it gets a little bit worse. So in March 2011, the judge from the four state cases, so not the federal level cases, but the state cases, Richard Baumgartner, was forced to resign. He admitted to a drug addiction, to purchasing prescription medications from convicts, and to basically doing things, exchanging favors with women for drugs. He pleaded guilty to official misconduct, and it was ruled that his ability to conduct trials had been impaired during his prior 2 years on the bench. So because of this, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation determined that Baumgartner was likely impaired while presiding over the trials of all four of the defendants, the state defendants in this case. So this is not including Eric Boyd. On December 1st, 2011, Judge John Kerry Blackwood granted all four of them new state trials.
Okay.
So prosecutors conceded that Baumgartner had been impaired during Vanessa Coleman's trial. So they agreed to have for her to have a retrial. And she was actually granted a $1 million bail. I don't think she got out. Like, I don't think she could pay it, but she was given bail. But they tried to appeal the decision to retry Davidson, Cobbins, and Thomas. Mm-hmm. But then the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals confirmed that the retrials could happen. In May 2012, the Tennessee Supreme Court finally overruled Blackwood's ruling to order new trials for Cobbins, Davidson, and Thomas. So their argument was that a trial judge's misconduct outside of the courtroom does not necessarily require a new trial unless the misconduct was shown to have affected the actual trial proceedings. Judge Blackwood was asked to reconsider the motion for new trials, and they were hopeful that they wouldn't have to go through all of this again. But unfortunately, in June 2012, Judge Blackwood once again granted new trials to Davidson, Cobbins, and Thomas. So I don't know what this guy's deal is, but like, so many people are saying do not give them new trials, and he keeps giving them new trials.
Yeah, and there's no way for them to actually prove without a doubt that he was under any kind of influence when he went to trial.
Right.
And these people are monsters. Right.
Yeah, like clearly they got indicted for that. Like, oh.
They got the punishment that they deserve to get, honestly. And everyone sees exactly. That, but this guy.
Yeah. So after this, prosecutors filed to have Judge Blackwood removed from the case. So they said he was emotionally invested in this case. He had a lack of candor with the local media. And they also cited the Supreme Court guidance that recusal should be considered before any other action. So their request for recusal was thankfully granted. And a new judge, Senior Judge Walter Kurtz, denied retrials for Cobbins and Davidson. So the two brothers. He did, though, grant retrials for Thomas and then Coleman. Vanessa Coleman already had her retrial granted. So Cobbins is currently serving his life sentence at the Northeast Correctional Complex in Tennessee, and Davidson is incarcerated at the Riverbend Maximum Security Institution serving his life sentence that's also technically a death sentence. All right, so first we're going to talk about Thomas's retrial. It happened after Coleman's, but it's a lot less complicated, so I just want to talk about that one first. On May 17th, 2013, his retrial ended and he was once again found guilty on all 38 counts that he faced. Mm-hmm. He was resentenced to life in prison, but this time he was granted the possibility of parole after 51 years.
Oh.
Yeah. On June 4th, 2013, Judge Kurtz sentenced him to 2 consecutive life sentences for the murders and 25 years for the rapes. He appealed his conviction to the Tennessee Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court, but they've all been denied. On November 20th, 2012, Vanessa Coleman's retrial ended, and she was convicted of facilitation of aggravated kidnapping, facilitation of rape, and facilitation of the murder of Shannon. These were all lesser charges than her initial convictions. Her lawyers argued for a 20-year sentence, while prosecutors wanted the maximum of 50 years. And on February 1st, 2013, she was sentenced to 35 years, minus the time she had already served. At sentencing, the judge said, quote, "The psychological torture of this unfortunate victim was immense. This crime is the most horrible murder case I have seen."
Yeah, now that she's had time to sit in prison and think about what she's done, I'm sure it is.
Mm-hmm. And so she was in this retrial because of this original judge's misconduct.
Right.
She was sentenced or convicted of lesser charges and her sentence was basically reduced.
It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
So she obviously appealed. All of her appeals were overturned. The judge said she clearly was at the house. Her journal entries proved that she was a dangerous offender. So all of her appeals were overturned. She is currently in the Tennessee Prison for Women, which is now known as the Deborah K. Johnson Rehabilitation Center in Nashville. She was first eligible for parole in December 2014, which she was denied, again in December 2020, and she was denied again. And thankfully, she is not eligible to go to the parole board again for 10 years, so she won't be able to go until December 2030. Her sentence expires on April 18th, 2036. So literally just under 14 years. Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Eric Boyd's state charges. So his initial conviction was just at the federal level, and he hadn't been charged at the state level yet, and that's why his conviction wasn't part of that, you know, judge that that had to step down, because those were all state cases. So on March 20th, 2018, over 11 years after the murders, he was indicted by the state on 36 counts. This included first-degree felony murder, first-degree premeditated murder, especially aggravated robbery, especially aggravated kidnapping, and aggravated rape. George Thomas actually testified as a witness in Eric Boyd's trial, and in turn, he got his first-degree murder convictions reduced to second-degree. And he got his aggravated rape conviction reduced to aggravated assault. So his sentence was reduced from life without the possibility of parole to 50 years.
What?
So now Thomas is serving his 50-year sentence at the Northwest Correctional Complex, and his sentence expires in May 2053. Isn't that just awesome? Just because he testified against this other guy?
Yeah, who was obviously there. I mean, they had...
And already in jail on federal charges. Like, yeah. I get that the state wants to charge him, but, like, come on. Now you're gonna let another guy out?
Do they need to charge him, though? Like, is that...
Yeah. Exactly. No, it's ridiculous. On August 13th, 2019, Eric Boyd was found guilty on nearly all of the charges, and he was sentenced to life in prison. His request for a new trial was denied, and he is currently serving his sentence at Federal Correctional Institution Beckley, which is a medium security prison in West Virginia. So back to the victims, their families ensured that their legacies would live on. Shannon Christian's family developed the Shannon Gale Christian Foundation and the Shannon Gale Christian Memorial Golf Tournament, And this provides a scholarship to a Farragut High School senior to be able to attend the University of Tennessee. And her father, Gary, now speaks at churches about how he is overcoming the anger from his daughter's murder and all of the trials that had to happen. There's also a foundation for Chris Newsom, and in his hometown, they hold an annual memorial baseball tournament, and there is a scholarship that is given out annually to a graduating Halls High School baseball player. On top of this, two new laws were introduced in 2014. So the Chris Newsom Act was introduced to eliminate the need for a judge's signature on a jury verdict after the delivery of a unanimous verdict. So this is basically saying if it's a unanimous verdict, the judge doesn't need to sign off on it. And this would have prevented the retrials from happening if this was in place back then. Yeah. So they're hopeful that that will help future cases that are ever in a similar situation. The Shannon Christian Act restricts attorneys and defendants in attempting to portray a victim in a negative light, such as making allegations about their behavior. This is because during trial, Davidson tried to allege that Shannon and Chris had come to his house to buy drugs. So this led the defense attorneys to question Shannon's character, and that was obviously really hard for her family because they knew that wasn't true, and it was awful seeing their daughter, who was a victim of this crime, being, like, her character being questioned.
And even if she was, that doesn't mean that she deserved to be raped, tortured, and murdered, suffocated.
Yep. And because of laws protecting the accused, Davidson's previous carjacking conviction was not allowed to be brought up.
Of course. Of course it wasn't.
Yeah. So the Shannon Christian Act wouldn't allow this to happen in the future. So that is amazing. Both of those are so amazing for families of other victims, because I just can't imagine having to go through that and those types of things happening.
And to have to go through the trials again. Like, you don't even, you know, normally you just don't even think about the families in that situation, how tormenting that must be for them.
Yeah. But yeah, that is the murder of Shannon Christian and Chris Newsom. It is absolutely horrific. One of the most horrific, brutal murders. And all murders are unnecessary. And
it was
like
they were bored, though.
Yeah, exactly. They just wanted, like, money and a car, maybe, and wanted to do something, and they did this. Like, how? Yeah. Ugh, it's so sick.
It is. It really is sick.
So, but yeah, I hope that you guys can join me in remembering Shannon and Chris as the amazing people that they were. I will post photos of them, as always, on our Instagram and Facebook. But that's all I have for you guys today. We'll see you in the next one. And until then, keep it human.
Bye.